Spend some time on the question of, are we saying that this is Gehari Ba'Yavla? Are we saying that you really have to be so fearless that even if your life is at risk, you're going to stick through it? And we discussed some svaras why you might say that, why it maybe sounds like that, and ultimately noted that there are many great poskim who said that it doesn't go so far. You're not actually required to risk your life if it's a real risk. And we mentioned some svaras that were not so solid, but that ultimately there's a lot of basis to say that. And we then brought in the question, which Rav Bakshi Daron discusses, the question of whether this Isser, is it an Isser, but on the Mamakom, that this is somehow a part of God's mission to the dying to bring truth into the world, or is it an Isser, but on the Mechavero, that you can't let your friend who's being exploited or victimized suffer without any recourse because you're too afraid to deal with it. So one just last topic to talk about is, so if we discuss this question of whether or not you have to risk your life, so what about the chiluk that you find in some poskim? There are those who write that, okay, you don't have to risk your life, but you do have to risk your money. That if the person says that if you paskin against me, I'm going to set fire to your crops, like the example the Rambam brings from the Medrash, or some other threat to your property, which, let's say, you're confident it's not a threat to life, but it is a threat to money. So there are some poskim who say that there you do have to still serve. You're not allowed to withdraw under those circumstances. And there is perhaps an extra basis to say that, a little synergy from last year. So those who were with us last year, and again, I forget those of you who weren't, but we discussed the sugi and ksudas and daf nun of hamavazveis al yavazveis yosem yichomesh. That the Gemara there says that one is not encouraged to spend more than a fifth of his money on stuck, is the context of the Gemara. That we're afraid that if you spend more than a fifth of your money, you're going to become impoverished. So that's a limit. But the Ramah brings this and expands it and limits it at the same time. Expands it to say that for positive mitzvahs, this is the rule also, you're not obligated to spend more than a fifth of your money on positive mitzvahs. But if it's an avera, if it's a negative mitzvah, then you have to spend all of your money rather than violate an avera. So one might say that maybe that's relevant to you. Right, why don't we say that here we have an Isser, also a guru. So, all right, you want to tell me it's not Yehud Ba'yav, or fine. But why shouldn't you have the rule that I have to spend all my money? So whatever threat this bully makes, this tough guy makes against my property, I should have to say, whatever it is, I'm ready to bear any cost because I have an Isser here. So this question is discussed in that sefer I mentioned yesterday, in Shulis Mishnas Yehoshua, Yehoshua Tevo. So he suggests two possible answers to that question. So why would anyone disagree with this? Right? We said that some folks could say that's indeed the din. You have to bear any financial price. But many don't assume that to be the case. My sham is a tshuva, not like that. That you're not obligated to undergo a great financial loss. So what's the difference? Why should it be that if you have an Isser here, so why should I be allowed to violate the Isser just to avoid financial loss if that's generally not the rule? Anyone want to suggest an answer to that? Yeah, sorry.
They don't necessarily agree with the Ramah's distinction.
Okay, so that's actually true. You're remembering from last year that I actually mentioned then that this Ramah, which is well known and is often expressed as basic halachic principle, the truth is it is somewhat of a machlokes, because it's not really found in earlier sources. And there were those who disagreed, perhaps most prominently the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon felt that that's not the din, and that the Gemara in the ninth parak of Brachos, which tells us, and the Pasuk says, that you have to worship God with all of your resources. So that means that even if you have to give up all of your money, so that's about Avos Hashem. You have to show careful hold out for Chomashim Medefa, sorry. So that idea that you have to love God with all of your resources, that means you can't be over the Avodah Zarah. So maybe that's what the Gemara is saying, that specifically that issue, turning away from God, you can't do it for any amount of money. But maybe one could take that as an indication that other mitzvos don't have such a stringent standard. So Aryeh is correct that there is somewhat of a dispute as to whether or not this rule really exists. But many take it as a given, like the Rambam says, that the rule does exist. So is there any other way to answer this question? Assuming within the Rama that there is such a rule, how else could you possibly answer this question? Are you good?
Maybe you would say that Belosa says that you shouldn't fear, but it has to be a illegitimate fear. I mean, perhaps this is a legitimate fear.
Oh, that's very interesting, actually. Okay, it's a good suggestion that which could address a lot of things. That maybe the whole Israel Osar Guru doesn't mean that when there's a real threat, you should ignore it. It means that one should only pay attention to a real threat, but to be overly careful at the expense of someone else, that's not necessarily appropriate. That's what's prohibited. So that's similar to one of the suggestions he has, which is he's maybe saying that that's essentially what the Torah is setting as a parameter here. That when it's Bari Hazeka, when you know there's a definite danger here, then that's excluded from this mitzvah to begin with. So he doesn't explain it exactly like you did, but the way you said it is a good way to say it, that maybe the whole nature of the Isser is to not be afraid of something that's not established as a genuine concern. Which parallels a little bit we mentioned yesterday, from the Shari Shuva, from Rabbeinu Yonah, which had also been commented upon in the Sefer Mishnah Yeshua, that Rabbeinu Yonah says the whole idea is we should have faith in God and understand that Shluchei Mitzvah in Nizokin. So there, that principle has an exception for when there is a clear danger. So too, one could say that that's simply outside the whole scope of the mitzvah. Okay, that's a good suggestion. There's another suggestion. Okay, yes.
Maybe that Hezek Mamon is the same as Hezek Guf, and and it's related to each other. So if you're afraid of your life, it's a similar thing as being afraid of all your money.
So there is what to discuss about that. But the problem is, once we're really working off the idea that there's a distinction, you're going to have to explain a lot to say that. And your point has some merit to it by itself, but you're going to have to explain a lot of other things if you're going to take that position, because the premise of this question here is that it's not Yehar V'Yavor, but still there's a din that a Lavan and the Torah you're not supposed to violate at any cost. So if you're going to say they're the same, then you have a harder time addressing that. So one approach you could take is that there's a question in general. This relates to, we talked about Yesh Koach Lakar Davar Torah a few weeks ago, this question came up. So what do we mean when we talk about the difference between a positive mitzvah and a negative mitzvah? Are we talking about classification as a lav or an asay? Or are we talking about passive versus active behavior? So one could say that Losa Guru is a good example, right? Because it's a lav. So maybe we should treat it with the stringency of a Losa asay. But you violated passively. Right? You violated by not adjudicating. So there's room to wonder what didn't apply to it. Do we treat it like a losa say and say spend all of your money? Or maybe we treat it like an essay and therefore it has more of a limited chiyuv. This question comes up very much. I think I remember seeing this discussion in all places in the Art Scroll biography of Chaim Ozer. I think for some reason there's a discussion about this question. About, let's say somebody's trying to raise money to give somebody a life-saving surgery. And so, you're not allowed to stand by when somebody's life is at risk. So maybe we should say, you have to sell your house. You have to do whatever it's going to take to help with this. Because it's a losa asay. So there are a couple of approaches one could take to that question. But one detail that's relevant is that there are those who say that this whole severity by Losa say is when you're actively going to do something wrong, but if it's a sin of omission, you're just going to be holding back, then maybe that doesn't kick in. So perhaps that logic would save you here also, and you could say that Losa Guru is a Losa say, but practically it commands behavior, and therefore not doing it, not doing that behavior, is treated by the rules of an essay. Hi. Okay, but to also, with one final approach here, is to go back to the approach that Rabakshi Daron has, where he raises the question, I guess it's a little bit similar to what Doug was asking before, different rules for Ben Adam L'Makum to Ben Adam L'Chaveru, that if we categorize this as a Ben Adam L'Chaveru, so then there's reason not to apply this rule. Not because we're careless about Ben Adam L'Chaveru's Chas V'Shalom, but just the logic is different. That basically, if it's a Ben Adam L'Chaveru, it's essentially like Hashavas Aveda, that your friend has a monetary loss, and you're trying to save them from the monetary loss. So there, it's important to draw a distinction between that and Gezel, where the logic will be very different. We're not talking about stealing from your friend. We're talking about not helping him prevent the loss. So when it comes to Hashavas Aveda, so we have rules that say that you're not obligated to lose money in order to save your friend from losing money. So if that's the nature of the mitzvah, that you're trying to prevent your friend from losing out, so then you have a right to hold on to your property first before helping him to hold on to his property. And that could also explain it, that you're not obligated to go through a financial loss in order to prevent that from happening. Okay, so maybe we'll close off this topic here. I'll just mention one of the Marmakom, which is on the Marmakomos, but just in case you didn't see it, so just it's interesting, so to be aware of it. And again, to link this sugya to one of our previous sugyas, so it's interesting if you saw also that the Or Zeruah quotes a view, that if you have three dayanim, who the Hagos Ashri quotes from the Or Zeruah, that if you have three dayanim who sit down to do a din, and one of them decides he's scared and bows out, so the other two are not able to finish it based on that. That even though, even according to the view that you could have Shnayim Shadonu, but that this is comparable to what Daniel says, I don't know, and that essentially the rule of Adaita the Tlasi, you see that they sat down expecting three Dayanim, so that's going to attach here as well, and two Dayanim cannot continue the din after one of them has chickened out. So it's just an interesting point of connection between the sugyas. We've noted a couple ways in which the sugyas of Pshara and one dying thing, I don't know, and Shnayim Shadanu and Losa Guru all have certain common elements that are being discussed here, so that's another one to keep in mind. Marty?
We said,
well, because if it depends on what we're trying to understand is the whole point here. But if we're going to say it's an open law, so then it probably doesn't have much to do with that. It's about establishing truth in the world. But if we're going to say this is a benod machavero, so what's the nature of benod machavero? I mean, how would we understand it? So presumably, the most likely conceptualization is that your friend is being exploited, is being victimized by somebody else, and he needs law and order to be opposed. He can't do it by himself. He needs somebody to come in and to assert things. So, therefore, you're going to do that by being the judge. So you're doing that in order to save him from the loss he's taking at the hands of the bully. So that is an obligation to him. But it shouldn't exceed your obligation, let's say, if he just lost his property. So if he lost the same amount of property, and the only way for you to return it is for you to take a week off your work and take a helicopter out to the Himalayas where he's hiding, and it's going to cost you many thousands of dollars, so then you're not obligated. So too, the same logic, I think it makes sense. I mean, I think that just if I had to pick a concept that is most comparable to what it would be, if it's a Ben Adam L'Chaveru, that would probably be the best fit. Okay, so now with that, let's segue to Pesach topics. So what I'm going to try to do in the next few minutes, let's see, time permitting, is add three more Pesach topics that all connect to the Sunday topic we've been talking about siag mehatorah, about the idea of a safeguard that is from the Torah itself. Let's see how many we can do. So one is, we spent some time on this topic we sort of talked about before, but not this part of it, but we talked about the question of chatzi shir. And we said that we have an iser in the Torah, the way we passing it in the Torah, of a chatzi shir, that normally when the Torah prohibits eating, like it does with chametz on Pesach, or like it does with chalev or chazir, or any other prohibition of eating, so in each case, there is a shir relevant that you have to eat a kezias in these examples in order to incur the punishment. To be chayiv karis on Pesach, to be chayiv malchus for eating chazir, or chayiv karis for eating chalev, whatever it is, you have to eat a kezias. That's the shir. And we mentioned that the Gemara, at the beginning of the 8th parak of Yuma, has a discussion about chatzi shir. What if you're going to eat less than this? Let's say you're going to have only a little Hershey's Kiss made of this item, made of chazer, made of chametz. So, is that mutter? And we saw the Gemara says, no, it's aser for sure. Question is, how aser is it? According to Reish Lakish, it's aser midrabanan. And according to Rabbi Yochanan, it's aser minhag Torah. And the Gemara had two possible explanations for Rabbi Yochanan's view, which we paskin like. Either it's based on a pasuk of kol chela, the drasha on that pasuk, or it's a svara of chazir tzdrufe. And we discussed two different ways to understand chazir tzdrufe. Chazir tzdrufe, the words literally mean that this is fit to be combined with more. And so, therefore, somehow that creates an isser. So we discussed two ways to understand that. Either that, what we call the kingship svara, that you can't eat just one, so we're afraid that if you have a little bit, you'll probably come to eat more. So that would seem to be a siag. Or the idea we call the marijuana svara, that if something is illegal and punishable at a certain level, so then that shows you that even less than that is wrong, is bad, and therefore there is logically a prohibition on any amount. And we said that if it's a siag, so that works well for Reish Lakish, who says it's an issur d'rabbanan. But it's also workable for Rabbi Yochanan, because that's what we've been talking about this whole time, that you can have a siag min ha-Torah. Okay, so far so good. That was a quick recap of what we had set up in that context. So to bring in another issue there, there's a question that the Achronim bring up. I remember when I was in 12th grade and I was taking bechinas for yeshivas in Israel, somehow this question, which isn't in the Gemara explicitly anywhere, somehow came up in at least two of the bechinas, just randomly, because it's an interesting tangential question that somehow works its way into a lot of things. Is there a concept of chatzi shir by mitzvos? Let's say, not just by an avera, but in a positive sense. So let's say, for example, you have matzah, but you don't have a kezias of matzah. All you have is a half kezias of matzah. So is there any value at all in eating that? If you assume that you have to have a kezias to be yotzei, nowadays one could add on that list, you could say maybe it has to be two kezias, one for the suda and one for the matzah, and you could say that a kezias has grown, there's a lot of literature about that, but let's even just leave all those issues aside. Let's say you have to have one kezias of matzah, and even let's say it's a small kezias, but let's say you have less than that. So what would you say? Is there any value in having a half kezias of matzah? Chatzi shir by mitzvos. Is there any value? What do you think? Anyone have a suggestion? Okay, Ari said a lot. Is anybody else? Okay, Ari?
Yes. Well, if it's a siyuk to make sure that you don't come to eat it, that is something that doesn't apply to mitzvos. You want to have more. And it's not something that will, we're not afraid that you might have more. We're not afraid, we don't want to answer this a little bit because we might come to have more later. So the flip side doesn't really work the other way for it to be offense.
Okay, so I think you're correct, basically, and there are scholars that point this out. Rezam Lechemi Goldberg has a book of Shir Marmoladin where who makes this point, and others point this out. So I think, Misvar, you're correct, that basically this issue, which is an important issue, is a nafgamina of the question of what does Chazal Tzrufim mean? Is it the potato chip svara, or is it the marijuana svara? That the marijuana svara basically does flip. Like, I guess that's a good word for marijuana. But it basically does have a positive correlate. That you could say that if a certain amount of this substance gets you punished, so that shows you that any amount is bad, so that does lend itself to being said in the reverse. But if a certain amount of this substance gets you rewarded, you get schar mitzvah for having a kazayis, so that seems to be sending the message that eating matzah on Pesach is a good thing. And therefore it makes sense that even any amount of matzah is a good thing. But if you say it's a siyav, so then that seems to only be logic that would apply to an aveira, that we're afraid, don't start because you may go too far and commit the aveira. But that logic does not seem to transfer over to mitzvos. So I think that is a correct way of looking at it. I will say, though, that al pi derech hadrush, I once said on Shabbos a few years ago, a different perspective. I think it was one of the years when Shabbos HaGadol was Parshas Tzav. So Parshas Tzav is where the pasuk Kol Chelev appears. So it's a chatzi shir topic already in the parsha. And it's Shabbos HaGadol, so maybe you could say that even this svara of siyag could apply to mitzvahs also, because we seek to have big aspirations. Maybe that's what Shabbos HaGadol is about, having aspirations of greatness and avodas Hashem. And that maybe it's true that even when we think it's too much for us, if we take a little step in that direction, we find that we can do more. And that maybe there is a way, at least al pi derech hadrush, of saying that the siyag svara has a positive correlate also, and that even according to that interpretation, there's what to say about chatzi shir by mitzvos, such as matzah. Practically speaking, I would think that it certainly makes sense to have the chatzi shir of matzah if you do, that I think the chazlut strufe svara is very compelling in this sense, that just like the clear message is that chametz is bad in any amount, the clear message does seem to be equally that matzah is good in any amount. This is something, as I mentioned before, that the Kajib Lover Rav seems to be touching upon in his tshuva about machine matzah, that it's possible to find some in-between area where it's something but not enough. And I think it makes sense to say that it certainly is something, and that maybe, could have pointed this out in the past, that we have an expression, we talk about whether you're Yotzei of Mitzvah or not. And we tend to use that interchangeably with whether you're Mekayim of Mitzvah. You accomplish a Mitzvah, you're Yotzei of Mitzvah. But the words don't translate exactly the same way. So Mekayim means to accomplish something, to fulfill something. And Yotzei is in itself a strange word. What it really means is you're Yotzei Yidei Chovoscha. You have left your obligation. You're no longer obligated because you have done enough that you're not obligated anymore. So it seems like it should be possible to distinguish, to say you're not yotzei mitzvah, meaning that you haven't left your obligation. If you find another half zayis of matzah, you should be having that because there's more still to do. But to say that means you're not makayim anything, that there's no accomplishment at all, I don't know if one has to necessarily mean the other, and that it seems likely that at least on a spiritual level, there is what to accomplish. The Mishnah Melech writes that there's no kiyum at all of a chatzi shir of mitzvos. The Chidah and others write that they think that even he is taking a strong stance, that he means that there's no value if you have the ability to do the whole thing. Let's say you have a whole kazayas in front of you and you decide, you know what, I'm only going to have half. So then that's where he takes his hardline stance. But somebody who only has this much, that's all he has. So then to eat that, so the Yechidah thinks that even the Shemalach would say, there is a kiyum. When you don't have, when you have the whole thing and you're only eating less, there are some who invoke Baal Tigra, that maybe it's a prohibition of subtracting from the mitzvos. That's also a position you find the aforementioned Kajig lover, this Chumas Eretzvi, at a different place. See, he wants to draw a line between a mitzvah kiyumis and a mitzvah chiyumis. Kiyumis and chiyumis. A mitzvah that is absolutely obligatory, and a mitzvah which isn't necessarily a chiyuv, but if you do it, you're fulfilling something. So he thinks that if it's optional to begin with, so then it really has to be the right amount. But if it's a chiyuvis, you have to do it, so then you work with what you have, and you'll consider that to be an obligation to have as much as you actually have. One could have all kinds of permutations in this question. You know, what would happen? How exactly if you measure things? Let's say you have two people who have a kazayas matzah between them. So is there any value? Should we say that one should split the matzah with his friend? And was there any value to that even? If we're each going to have half a kazayas, is that something? And is that something worth trading your full mitzvah for? So that's something the poskim have talked about, which revolves around these issues. So that's another application of this whole siag d'oraisa question to a concept related to Pesach. Okay, so that's topic one. Now let's try to get two more in. So there are a number of practices that we have on Pesach which have developed in recent years, and both of them have some degree of controversy associated with them, and it's worth exploring what's involved in each of them. And they both have a connection to a topic of a siag min haTorah, as we will see, perhaps somewhat creatively. So first of all, I want to talk for a minute about the topic of afikoman. So we have a practice to do something with the afikoman besides the mitzvah to eat the afikoman, but the afikoman is designated at the beginning of the Seder, is eaten at the end of the Seder, and what happens in between. So there are various practices. Many have a practice to have the children steal the afikoman and ransom it back. So that practice, I don't mean to criticize anyone's mitzvah, it's certainly a widespread practice. Happens to me, if you ask me, I'm going to advocate not to do it that way, for reasons that we'll explain. And I think that that's a mitzvah which has better alternatives. In my family, in the household in which I grew up, so we never had it that way, that the children steal the afikoman, but rather the practice was that the father hides the afikoman and the children look for it and get rewarded for finding it. And I think that's preferable, again, with all due respect to the very widespread alternate meaning. And just to explain why. So first of all, where does the whole practice come from? And it's the whole idea of stealing the afikoman. So it's not in the Gemara, unless you read a certain Gemara that way, which I guess is kind of a circular point. So it's only in the Gemara if you think the Gemara says it. So the Gemara has a line on Daf Kuftes Imsachin that Chotzvin es hamatzos kidei shlo yishenu ha'ketan, that we grab the matzos so that the children don't sleep. So you might say, okay, there you have it. So you steal the matzos to keep the children engaged. So the truth is, that's not what most of the Rishonim say. So if you look, for example, at Rashi, so Rashi has two different explanations. Rashi says either it means that we lift up the matzos to show people and to show the children in order to keep them engaged, or it means that we eat quickly. We want to hurry up and get to the matzos quickly so that the children won't fall asleep before that. Now, obviously, it's a certain amount of tension that we have nowadays because of daylight savings times and the topic we spoke about on Sunday about not applying the benefits of Tosefis to the Seder. So we have to wait till it's very dark to start, and then that is certainly at odds with our goal of keeping the children awake, but whatever it is, that's a challenging balance. So once we have them, we want to keep them awake, so that's Rashi's second interpretation. The Rashbam has a third interpretation that we're afraid that if the children have too much matzah, they'll become drowsy and they will fall asleep. So to make sure they don't fall asleep, so we grab the matzah away from them so that they shouldn't come to get drowsy. So far we're not seeing an interpretation of the children taking it and ransoming it. Now the Rambam may sound that way. The Rambam writes that Kotvin Zemiyad Zed, basically this one grabs it from that one's hand, that may or may not be an allusion to this practice, but it's closer. The Rambam in there notes that there are the other interpretations that we just mentioned. But maybe on some level this is an allusion to this practice. However, I think it's problematic to interpret it that way, because the Rambam himself is the basis for a strong objection to this practice. There is a Gemara Maseches Bavli Tzia, Daf Samach Aleph, where the Gemara talks about the Pasuk in Parshas Kedoshim, a little bit advanced Parshas here, after you enter for the Parshas Kedoshim. So the Pasuk says, Lo Signovu, that you should not steal. So the Gemara asks, well, we already know that you're not supposed to steal. So why does the Gemara have, why does the Torah have to give an additional Isser not to steal? So the Gemara says over there that it means to tell you that you shouldn't steal even if you plan on giving it back. So why would you steal if you plan on giving it back? So we're not talking about borrowing something for temporary usage, because that's really stealing too. We say that Hashol, Shalom Bershus, at least Nikra Gazlan, that if you borrow something, you borrow a car to the joyride, that's called stealing too. So that's not what we mean, but we mean you're stealing it for a very short period of time without using it and plan on giving it back. So why would you do that? Why would somebody do such a thing?
Jokes.
So it sounds like it's a joke. It sounds like it's a practical joke. You're doing it to annoy somebody. So the language of the Gemara is Lo Signo Almanas Lameka, that you shouldn't steal, that you're looking to irritate the person. That's probably how Lameka could be translated. It's an Aramaic word that means to irritate, to annoy. So don't steal with that in mind. You're not going to keep it. You're not even going to use it. You're just trying to irritate the guy by having his property disappear. So that's something that you shouldn't do. There are some who would translate a little differently. Some say it's not necessarily that you're trying to give the guy a hard time. Maybe you're trying to teach him a lesson. Maybe he leaves his property vulnerable, and you want to show him that he could easily be robbed. So you want to take it and then give it right back to him so he should see how easily this could happen. So that doesn't have the intention to annoy, and yet some of the Rishonim say that's what it means. So you could say L'amanas L'meika comes from the Aramaic of Nikita, to take something, Naka, and that therefore we translate as don't take just for the sake of taking. You might think that I'm taking it to use, I'm taking it to keep it. So we're saying no, that even just for the sake of taking, don't take something. And that's a prohibition by itself. There was a minority view in the Rishonim, very hard to understand, although there are big Rishonim who felt like this, like Rabbeinu Tam. But there's a minority view that it actually does mean that you're going to keep it. And it's just talking about your motive, that you're going to take it forever in order to annoy the guy or teach him a lesson. And that therefore, that's prohibited also. And the reason these Rishonim say it can't mean that you're going to take it just for a very short time, because taking something as a joke for a very short time is Maisim B'chol Yom. It happens every day. It can't be that's what we're talking about. So the Ketzos HaChoshen has a predictable response to that. What do you think he says to that objection that it happens every day? It's the wrong thing. It shouldn't happen. The Gemara is saying that you shouldn't do this, even if you thought it was the kind of thing that could happen every day. And that's really the view of most Rishonim, that even to take something temporarily, take something forever, most Rishonim say for sure that that's neighbor. Your victim's not going to be reassured by the fact that you're not using it if you're keeping it forever. It's hard to believe that anyone's going to feel that that makes a difference at that point. So rather, it means that you're only taking it for a short time and you're giving it back, but still it is prohibited. So the question is, why is it prohibited? And the Gemara also gives another example, by the way. The Gemara has kind of a twist on Robin Hood. You heard Robin Hood would steal from the rich and give to the poor. So the Gemara talks about a stranger, Robin Hood, who would steal from the poor to give to the poor. because maybe you might think that you have a friend who needs some charity, and he's not going to accept the charity. So what you'll do is you'll steal the stuff, you'll get caught with the stolen stuff, back in the time you have to find a dying mumcha, right, to give us a little synergy here, so the dying mumcha will be able to, a dying samach, will be able to impose a knas of kefil, and then you'll pay kefil to the guy, and that's your very convoluted plan to get stuck into this person. So even though you're trying to benefit the person, no good, says the Gemara, lo signo v'amanas l'shalim teshlum mikefil. That's also not acceptable. So what's the issue here? So you could say that the issue is that it has to do with the nature of Geneva. Now what is Geneva? So Geneva, we know that Halacha distinguishes between Gezel and Geneva. Like Gezel and Geneva. That Gezel is open robbery. I put a gun to your head, I say, give me all your money. That's Gezel. While Geneva is secret robbery. I pick your pocket, I steal something from your drawer when you're not looking. So that's Geneva. So if that's the case, so it's interesting that Geneva is more stringent than Gezel, because Geneva, we just mentioned, has Kefil, and Gezel does not. So why is Geneva worse than Gezel? So the basic answer is that Geneva is Gezel plus. That Gezel means to illegitimately deprive someone of their money. You steal their money, that's Gezel. And Geneva is that plus being sneaky and tricking them and deceiving them. That's the added component that is part of Geneva. So Geneva has everything that Gezel has, plus it has more. So maybe what we're talking about in this Gemara is Geneva minus Gezel. What if you have the sneakiness of Geneva, but you're not actually keeping the money? You're going to give it back. So you have the Geneva process without the Gezel. So the Chiddush here might be that that's still wrong. Reb Ruchem Fishel Perlo, in his commentary on Reb Sadji Bon Sefer HaMitzvos, says that when you rob someone, when you're gonave somebody, so you cause them both financial loss and emotional suffering that comes from being robbed. So the Chiddush here is that the emotional component by itself is prohibited, even without the monetary component. So it's interesting that there are those who actually say that Gezel, Almanas Lamekat, is actually mutter. That this whole issur doesn't apply to Gezel, because it's all about the sneakiness of Geneva. There are some who want to explain, there's a Gemara in the end of the first paragraph of Baba Basra that says that Eov, right, we all know that Eov was a pretty good guy, right? So there's a Gemara that says that Eov would steal fields from orphans. That sounds pretty bad. That doesn't sound like the kind of thing a good guy would do. So the Gemara says he stole fields from orphans and he would basically flip them. He would be a real estate developer. He would make the fields worth more and then he'd give them back to the orphans. So this was his way of doing staka. He would give them greater value by taking over their property, making it worth more, and then giving it back to them. Okay, so that's very noble. But doesn't that sound like what we just said? That basically you're stealing in order to benefit the victim. So it's great that you have this motive, but we just said that's still prohibited. You're not allowed to do this even to benefit the victim. So it's a discussion. How do you explain Eov's behavior if there's an issur of Almanas Lameka? So some say maybe this is a proof that Eov wasn't Jewish and that this is not one of the seven issur of Noah. And others say that, no, maybe there's a difference between Geneva and Gezela. That this was Gezel, that Eov just walked in and took over their field, so it wasn't Geneva, it was open Gezel. And Gezel doesn't have an Isser of Almanas L'shalom Teshlum Mikefil. It doesn't have an Isser when you're trying to benefit the victim. It's only Geneva that Geneva has this component. There was a very strange back and forth in the journal Tchumen a few years ago. Not so strange, just this part of it was a little strange. Chumen is a wonderful journal that comes out of Eretz Yisrael, has all kinds of halachic discussions about topics that are relevant to contemporary life in Israel and around the world. And a few years ago, many years, a few decades ago, they also, for a while, published an English version called Crossroads, which had some English versions of some of the articles there. So there was a whole debate then that somebody wrote an article once for Truman at Crossroads where he said that a teacher is not allowed to confiscate property from the student. The student is playing on his iPhone during class, so the teacher is not allowed to confiscate it, even though he plans on giving it back, it's still usher, it's gonev omenas to make it. And that's what we said, that even if you take something and give it back, it's still prohibited. So, the editor of the journal, he disagreed with this pretty strongly, and the thrust of his disagreement was that he felt that the teacher is basically the government of the class. It's basically Hefker Bezdin Hefker. The teacher has the authority to do that, and the parents, when they send their child to the school, they know that these are the terms, so it's hard to say that this is really a neva. But as one minor point he mentions, is that even if you want to say that it is gneva, so or if you want to say that it's stealing, but it's not gneva menasameka, it's gezel menasameka. The teacher is doing this openly, he's not picking the pocket of the student, he's going to come right over and take away the phone. So if anything, it's gezel, and gezel menasameka is not prohibited, and therefore the teacher should have the authority to do this. So that was part of that whole discussion. So, Marty, you have a question?
Say that only gazebo would have an emotional component? Why does gazebo have that?
Okay, so now, just as a little bit of a side discussion. So, you might think that this all sounds a little strange, right? You'd say that if I have a choice, if I know I'm going to lose my wallet one way or another, and I have a choice, I could be mugged at gunpoint, which would be gazebo, or I could have my pocket picked, which would be gazebo. Which would I choose? So probably most people would say, put me in the gneva column. Who wants to go through the trauma of being mugged at gunpoint? So they would assume that the gazel is a bigger ordeal than the gneva. So that throws this all into a little confusion. Why are we saying that gazel is less bad, that gneva is gazel plus? Most of us, if we had to choose, would endure gneva rather than endure gazela. So I think the answer is that when you imagine this scenario of gazel, of being mugged at gunpoint, so there's all kinds of other isurim that are happening there also. The threatening of a person, the instilling pachad, is a serious onos devarim. If there's any actual physical violence, so then that certainly adds other isurim. Even threatening physical violence, we know, is a separate isur from the Gemara, from the pasuk in Parsha Shmos. So all of these are actually separate isurim. So in our minds, this is what we would imagine happening, but it's not necessarily the fundamental part of gezel. So, in order to give an example, if I was going to be gozel your laptop, so if I were just right now to take it off your desk and walk out before you can stop me, so it's not so traumatizing, but that's probably one way to have pure gezel. While if I take it when you're not looking, so then that's gneva. But if I would threaten you or beat you up and take your computer, so that would involve other yisurim that would constitute the emotional downside of the experience. While in gneva, the feeling of being violated and the tsar that you get from finding your property missing, that's a separate emotional component.
I mean, yeah. Aren't they both going to have like an emotional harm?
So the question is, in order to address this question, you have to imagine a gezel which doesn't involve any other averus. So that's hard to imagine in our scenario. The examples we've come up with would have other complicating averus, and we have to separate those out in order for this to make sense. So, what does all this have to do with what we're talking about? So, what if, let's say, all we've said so far, it sounds like this is still a victimization. It's a different level of victimization than normal gneva, but the point is that normally if you rob me, if you're a gonev for me, I'm victimized in a couple ways. And here I'm victimized in some ways, even if not in all of the same ways. But what if I'm not victimized at all? What if, let's say, I want to test out my security system? So I hire you to break into my house so I can find if it works or not, if I find that my security system works. So, well, why isn't that gonev? Let's say I hire you to break into my house and steal my stuff. Right, so
taking the object, not...
Okay, so do that. Hire, break into my house and take my stuff. Take my object. So, is that mutter?
And if I'm in your house and I said, it's a really little candlestick, and you would not eat it, then that's not going to be either.
Correct.
Because I'm standing in your house and brought together, supposed to wear a black hat.
Well, so all right, so that's an important distinction you're making. Where would you come? What's the difference between that and giving you the object? So here I'll explain why I think it's different. That we could have said, based on what we've said so far, that if I hired someone to break into my house to come up through a second floor window and carve a hole in the window and get around the alarm system and to test the alarm, so you might say that should be mutter. There's no victim there. So there's a basis from the Rambam to say that it's awesome. Because the Rambam, in quoting this din of Lo Signa V'Menasa Meikat, so the Rambam writes, the reason that you're not allowed to steal, even if you're going to give it back, says the Rambam that really this isn't Geneva because you're going to give back the property. So it doesn't actually share the core element of Geneva. But it's also bad mitos, exactly, that you should not be margil yourself, you shouldn't train yourself in Geneva. This is going to cultivate the sense of sneakiness, and therefore you shouldn't do it. So therefore, it sounds like he's saying that you shouldn't do it even if there's no victim, even if the person is totally okay with it. To figure out a plan to break into someone's house and take his stuff, even with his full permission, would still be wrong because you're training yourself in sneakiness.
This might be random, but what if, let's say you're doing it in a virtual reality, you're doing it in a game.
Yes.
In order to win the game, you have to sneak around
a little,
the level.
Right, it's a good question. It's a little subjective. I think it's an important topic to discuss because it gets into broader issues of the effects that things that we're doing have on us. A very valid topic. In the interest of time, I'm not going to pursue it just because it involves a serious question of just how far to go with this point, which is a very fair question, but a little bit outside of our time scope. So I'm going to push it off as for a future time when it can be more appropriately discussed. Yes. So there are those who say, based on this Rambam, here's going to be one of our links, there are those who say, based on this Rambam, that, oh, the Rambam apparently holds that Goni v'amanas l'meikat must be a din d'rabbanan. Why? What makes them say that?
He gives a reason,
which sounds like a siag, right? It sounds like, oh, we're afraid you'll turn into a ganav if you do this kind of stuff. So therefore, even though it's not by itself geneva, don't do it. So some have read this Rambam to say that this is a siag. So I think you don't have to say that for two reasons, right? What's the first reason you have to say it's a d'rabbanan? Because that's right, that's our whole topic, it's a siag d'oraisa. So this could also go on our list of something that is a siag, even if it's min ha-Torah. But further, I don't know, this is also just valuable for our understanding of the whole topic. I don't think that's what you call a siag. I think he's giving an explanation of what's behind it, which, if you're going to call that a siag, so every mitzvah is a siag, because if you read the Sefer Achina, for example, so the Sefer Achinuch has a reason for every mitzvah of the Torah. So you have 613 explanations. So you're going to say that each one is a siyag? That's because there's a way to explain how it connects to this midah, to that midah. I don't think that that's necessarily a siyag. I think that's just a tamni ha-mitzvah. So it's explaining what's going on. So I'm not so convinced by this whole approach. But there are those who say that's what the Rambam is getting at, that this is a siyag, and maybe that means you have to say it's the Rabbanan, but like we've been seeing, it's perfectly viable to say that it's a din min ha-Torah, and it's still possibly a siyag. But, hanogeya l'inyanenu for Pesach, so it would seem to me that if you have this concern, so this is definitely not what you want to train your children to do. You don't want to give your kids a game where you're telling them, okay, kids, now go out there and practice your Geneva skills and steal the Afikoman from your father. That would seem to go against the position of the Rambam and itself, even without the Rambam, be an understandable concern. So even though, again, this is a widespread minig to do this, to have this practice, and I'm not trying to disparage anybody's minhagim, I'm sure there are many people in this room who have this practice, but I think it's significantly questionable for this reason, and she just mentioned that there are many who agree. So I was looking at one sefer on Shabbos that said that this is this minig is discouraged in the Sefer Chof Yaakov, in Chabad, in Lelov, in Karlin, in Medvarna, among the Sfardim, that there are many who don't have this minig, and they say explicitly, Shlo Yar Galatzmo B'Geneva, the whole idea of training your children in Geneva seems to go against many of our core values. And I just want to mention, in that spirit, two points of irony. So some explain this practice, trying to explain how did it develop that you should steal the Afikoman. So some explain it based on an idea, a very strange idea that you find in some Sfarim, that when Yaakov took the Bechorah from Esau, so the Pasuk says, Achicha ba b'mirma, your brother Yaakov came with cleverness, as the uncle says, and there is an explanation in some Sfarim, it was a very roundabout idea, that it was Pesach night that night, and that part of Yaakov's plan was he brought food to Yitzchak, that would be the Afikoman. So now Yitzchak's not allowed to eat after the Afikoman, so he couldn't eat Esau's meal. So that Yaakov had this whole shtick that basically involved an Afikoman, so we also use Mirma, we also use trickery in Geneva in dealing with the Afikoman. So aside from the fact that that's a very far-fetched interpretation, but I think also that quite the opposite point is true. That we find in the context of that whole story with Yaakov and the Bechorah, this is a point that was made by the Yeshiva Kaviyavner, Goldbeck, and Hasichos, so that Saladinsky makes the same point, that we find that Yaakov, who was very apprehensive about this whole plan, that Yaakov had a tefillah, he said, Hatzileini misfas sheker, that he asked God to save him from lips of falsehood. And the idea is, as these commentators explained, as Rashid explained, and Rudinsky explained, that, okay, so Yaakov understood that he had to do this action because that was what Rivka told him to do. He had to do this, it was necessary for the future. But he was afraid that it would have an impact on his personality, that he'd become a sneaky person, he'd become a dishonest person. So he had a tefillah to God, he said, okay, I have to do this, but please save me from having any kind of impact from this. Don't let this change my personality. Teach an endless Yaakov. Yaakov is all about truth. So don't let me become somebody different who is going to be inclined towards falsehood because I performed this action. So that's really the message there. So to honor Yaakov by teaching our kids to steal, when his whole tefillah was that I shouldn't have any hashpah on my personality and my descendants from this isolated act of trickery, I think very much is the opposite of the whole way that we're meant to honor Yaakov. That's one point of irony. A second point of irony, I saw in a Sefer, also over Shabbos, that says, I saw a few Sfarim that discuss what happens if your child steals the Afikoman and negotiates a price that's too high. So if he asks for too much, so one Sefer says, just say no and use a different matzah, you can still do that at that point. So that's, I guess, that's a good lesson for your child, if you know that they can overplay their hand. But so another Sefer that says that if you agree to pay a high price, give them an expensive gift, so you should make sure to go through with it. That even though the Gemara says that you're not actually obligated to give someone a gift unless you actually make a kinyan, because especially if it's a big gift, so they might understand, they understand that it might not happen. So you're not actually committed to doing it until you make a kinyan. But here, it said the Sefer, here you should go through with it because there's a Gemara at the end of the Sefer Sukkah, which makes this point that you shouldn't tell a child you're going to give them something and not give it to them because they will learn to lie. They will learn that dishonesty is okay. So here again, I think that's a pretty ironic point that we're saying that when you're teaching your child how to steal and how to ransom back your property from you, make sure to pay the whole ransom so they shouldn't learn to lie. I would think that you shouldn't do the whole thing in the first place, so they shouldn't learn to lie. You shouldn't teach them this whole plan. That's really a kind of roundabout way of saying things. And that's perhaps part of the message here as well. So it's interesting to quickly follow up on that point. I saw from my teacher by Aaron Levine, Zichron Levracha, who once commented, was actually commenting on something I wrote about the idea that it's mutter l'shanus b'fnei hashalom, that you're allowed to fudge the truth for the sake of peace. So Rabbi Levine pointed out that that's true, maker adin, but there are some situations where you shouldn't do it. So let's say, for example, somebody calls your house and you can't come to the phone right now. So you'll tell your wife, say, tell them I'm not here. So that, we assume, is okay, because the alternative is saying, oh, tell him I'm sitting here, but I have no interest in speaking to him right now. I find him very irritating. Tell him that I don't want to speak to him. So that'll cause bad feelings. So it's preferable just to say you're not here, and that's mutter b'shanas b'fnei Hashem. So that is probably true. But, as Rabbi Levine quotes from others, that to say that to your wife is one thing. To say that to your five-year-old son, tell your son, say, Abba's not here. So that is a mistake, because your son is just going to get the message that it's okay to lie, that Abba tells him to lie. And he's not going to understand that this is a different kind of scenario, that it's Mekneh HaShalom. So therefore, that's a crucial point, that when you're dealing with younger children, so you have to be careful in how these things are transmitted. And that's, again, an additional reason here, not to necessarily feel you have to come through the big ransom, but that maybe this isn't the ideal practice to begin with. Again, with all due respect to those who have the practice, and still I think there's room to say that there are alternatives that are preferable. I also saw quoted, I believe in the name of Shlomo Zalman, that even those who do have this practice should be careful. They shouldn't call it Geneva Safikomen. They should call it Chatifa Safikomen. They shouldn't call it stealing. They should call it grabbing the Afikomen, because even in language you shouldn't try to convey that this is something that has any connection to your neighbor in the world, that this isn't the kind of message that you want to give to your children. And that's an important point. So, David, this is already related to what you had asked before, but the next point, I'm just trying to squeeze in the next few minutes. So let's talk for a very brief time about the fascinating practice of Mechiras Chametz. So Mechiras Chametz, I'm going to take an opposite attitude towards, and I defend the minhag of Mechiras Chametz. And yes, I'm well aware that there are many, many who are not so comfortable with Mechiras Chametz and had all kinds of objections, whether they are Balbatim or whether they are Yidoyei HaAchronim and even the Rishonim, many who had much to object to. And with all due deference to that, I just want to, and very significant due deference to that, but I just want to mention a story to justify it and to explain why Klal Yisrael has embraced this practice to the extent that it has, and especially why even more so, or significantly more so, than Mehetah Mechira, which I think we spoke about at the beginning of the year, which has some ostensible similarities, but we mentioned at the time, I think, many ways in which Mechiras Chametz is less problematic than Mehetah Mechira, which is not to disparage that either, but just to clarify the issues at hand. So when it comes to Mechiras Chametz, and you know, add Hetu Mechiras, so you probably hear jokes people make about it, but I think the whole thing is kind of a game. And somebody once commented that the Orthodox Jews, the rabbis, are going to come out and prohibit smoking, but the Orthodox Jews aren't worried, they're going to sell their lungs to a non-Jew. So, for the record, that doesn't work. But it provokes the question of why doesn't it work? Why is it that sometimes we have a method of Mechira that works, and sometimes that method of Mechira that doesn't work, and where's the line drawn? So there's a lot to discuss about that. We're not going to have time to go through it all. But when it comes to Mechiras Chametz, so there are those, again, among the Gedolei HaAchronim and also among just contemporary individuals who may not be in that level, but to raise the question that isn't this basically a game, right? Here, what happens when you sell your Chametz? So first of all, the Chametz remains in your house. Second of all, the Chametz, you know, always ends up coming back to you after Pesach. It's never happened that the Chametz hasn't come back to you. And you know that the purchaser never ends up coming over on Chol HaMoed and opening your closets and taking any of the Chametz. So if all of this is true, so doesn't this mean it's basically a game? Doesn't this mean that this is a way of not having our cake and eating it too? That essentially we're claiming that we're not owning the Chametz, but we really are owning the Chametz, so it's all just a fake Kenyan, doesn't have any real Gemiras Das. Isn't that the case? So there were those who raised all of these objections, but nonetheless, the minhag that embraces this, or at least embraces it partially, at least not for chametz gomer and the like, but to whatever extent this minig is embraced, I think there is one to justify it and one to explain it. And this goes back to our topic of siag min haTorah, that essentially, what is mechiras chametz meant to address? It's meant to address the isser of Bayura Bayimatzeh, right? We're not allowed to own chametz on Pesach. So, if you recall, that isser of Bayura Bayimatzeh, that might be a siag min haTorah. That the Ran, I think I gave you this to look at, right? The Ran on the first daf of Pesachim suggests that he raises the question, why is it that we're not allowed to own chametz on Pesach? So he mentions that the possibility that maybe this is a siag, that we're afraid that if you're going to own chametz on Pesach, maybe you'll come to eat chametz on Pesach. So you'll say, all right, but we have other isurim in the Torah, and we don't have a prohibition of owning. We're allowed to own pork, so why is it that we're allowed to own chazer, but we're not allowed to own chametz? So one possible reason is, and this also connects to our initial topic of why Chazal and others make safeguards the way they do. So one reason is severity. Chametz is an isser kares and chazer isn't. But another reason is just assessing the risk. So you could say, listen, if you wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning and you're hungry and you go into the kitchen and there happens to be a pork in your fridge for some reason, so you're not so likely to make yourself a pork sandwich because you've never had a pork sandwich. So even at 2 o'clock in the morning, it's not so likely to happen. But if you come down Pesach night at 2 o'clock in the morning and there is bread and butter in your kitchen, so you might make yourself a peanut butter sandwich because 51 weeks a year you could have a peanut butter sandwich. So you might forget that it's Pesach and that's more of a danger. So however you understand it, so that's what the Ran suggests, that Bayira Bayimatzeh is an Isser in or Nisr Daraisa. It's clearly Nisr Daraisa, but it's a Siag min haTorah. It's there to prevent us from violating the Isser of eating chametz, which is what we're really concerned about. So if that's the case, so you could say, all right, so we're trying to stay away from eating chametz. So what will keep us away from eating chametz? So you could say there are two things that will keep us away from eating chametz. One is simply not having access to any. If we don't have any chametz in our possession, we don't have access to any, so that's one way to make sure that we won't eat any chametz. But a second way to keep us away from eating chametz is that if the chametz is in our possession or is in our physical proximity, but if it's subject to an isser of lo sigzol, so that will also keep us away. That because we are so careful, this is to address Darwin's question also, because we take this principle so seriously that we're not allowed to take somebody else's property, so that will also stop us from eating the chametz that might be in our house. So if that's the case, so all we're trying to accomplish with mechiras chametz is to create a technical isser of lo sigzol. It doesn't mean that it has to actually involve anything more than that. It just means that we need it to be us or al pidin for us to take it. So it has to be somebody else's property, even if it's only technically true, but the mice it's true, so that will do it. So perhaps that's the practice here, that we are creating an Isser signal. We are selling this to a non-Jew, and now it's his property, so therefore it's no longer shy for us to eat it, because we would never take somebody else's property. So that perhaps is the ideal here, and this kind of again shows how we take these two halves equally seriously, that this is a tremendous statement about the zehiras that we have among us, that we're basically saying that we're willing to stake our sirkaris on our belief that we will be careful about this, that we're not going to take somebody else's property, and that's going to be enough. So that's a powerful statement, and there has to be a synergy between the two. Somebody once asked me when I said this explanation that maybe we should say then that people who cheat on their taxes can't sell their homes. So that's a fair point. And as you say, that if somebody's not going to take the issue seriously of not stealing, then maybe it does. Taka doesn't work. Maybe it has to be something that one does relate to with tremendous gravity. Which is why I also think that one should not be quick at all to take an attitude of, well, the purchaser is Michael, if I want to do this, I want to do that, which relates also to your question of going into the house when they sold the house, that I think we want to be very slow very hesitant to take an approach that, well, the purchaser is probably mochel on this, probably mochel on that, because once you start thinking like that, then you can start thinking all kinds of loopholes and rationales, and that's exactly what we want to try to avoid. And there's a significant discussion in the poskim. Every year you get a shaila like this, and a long number of poskim talk about this question, that what happens if, let's say, you open up your closet on Pesach and you find a bottle of schnapps that you forgot about, that you didn't include in the mechira, and now what should you do? So should you destroy it? Should you not destroy it? So poskim take different approaches on this. I happen to relate much more to the approach that you should not destroy it, that you should put it away. Because, first of all, I think it's old. When you fill out your shtar and you identify the places where the chametz is, you're not saying that I'm selling only the chametz in those places. You're saying, I'm selling all my chametz. And you want to know where my chametz is, so you can come get it. Here's where most of it is. Here's where the rest of it is. Here's where you can find it. But you're selling all the chametz that you have, so I think it's included in the sale. But in any event, if it's possibly included, so then for you to say, well, I want to be machmir and destroy the chametz I'll pour it down the toilet, so then you are possibly stealing this from the purchaser. And that's something which we don't want to take lightly. It's something that we want to be very careful about, working on the assumption that that's what makes all this work, that we work on the assumption that this is not something that we can be casual about. So I would think you should put this away with this old chametz. After Pesach is over, if you decide that you're worried about chametz over Pesach and you want to destroy it, then maybe it's up to you to do that if you want to. But during Pesach, I think there's a serious question that you're possibly stealing from the purchaser, and also the attitude that you can do that casually could have all kinds of other implications here. So I'll take a question in a second, but I just want to end with a point here that we've... Smag writes that the Geula, we're waiting for the redemption. Pesach is a time when we talk about one redemption and we anticipate another redemption. That if we're waiting to be redeemed, so redemption is never going to happen as long as the Jews are not perceived as people who are moral and people who are decent. Because there will be a Chil Hashem. Nations of the world will say, how could God redeem this nation? They don't even know how to be basically moral people. So if we want there to be a redemption, so we have to make sure that not only are we from in all ways, but that we are perceived as people who are moral and decent, so that it won't be a Chil Hashem when God decides to redeem us. So maybe we could suggest that that's also a part of this minhag, that we want to show how careful we are about morality. So therefore, at Pesach time, we specifically enter into a monetary agreement with the nations of the world, and we make sure to treat that incredibly seriously and to show that this is something that we esteem and that we value, and that that's going to typify us and represent our essence. So just to focus on these two practices, which I'm taking opposite attitudes towards, but in terms of Afikomen and Mechiras Chametz, these are two areas in which we have the opportunity to make sure that our general value of care in Mamonos, care in Adam Chavero, is interwoven with our ritual practice on Pesach, and that's something that's important for us to take seriously and to make sure that we're careful about. Arye?
On the little tinsel part, this wouldn't have any difference if it was Chametz Gamar or
Right, so I think one could take this logic and extend it to Chametz Gamar as well. There are those who aren't comfortable with this. It's a very widespread attitude, and again, not to disparage that. Some of them, largely the objection is because they're concerned that it's a harama, they think it's a way of getting around the law, and therefore they're not willing to do this for deraisas, maybe for the rabbanans, which I think we mentioned, dovetails with our whole discussion of the nature of deraisas and rabbanans, and they're working off the assumption that this is something that addresses the letter of the law, but not the spirit of the law. So when you have a deraisa, so we're concerned about spirit of the law, and you have a rabbanan, there's no spirit because it's all about compliance. But we're suggesting a little bit differently that maybe this is the spirit of the law also, in dealing with selling your spirits, that both the letter of the law and the spirit of the law could theoretically be consistent with such an approach. Morty?
You said the last one about the good one happening.
I believe it's a smock, if I remember correctly. Yeah, I can tell you the exact my muffle later, and I'm going to have to check again to get the smock. Okay, so I guess we'll end there. I wish everyone a chag kosher v'sameach. You should have a wonderful yontif. I look very forward to seeing you after Pesach when we chazer and prepare for our time together in June. But, oh well.